Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like now to welcome video artist, musician, and pioneer of new media, Stena. Her retrospective exhibition, Stena 1970 to 2000, opens at Site Santa Fe on Friday from 5 to 7 in the evening. And Jean Youngblood is the author of Expanded Cinema, the first book about video as an art medium. And he's professor of emeritus of moving image arts at the College of Santa Fe. Welcome, both of you.
Glad to be here.
Thanks.
Great to have you here. Now, Stena, you were born and raised in Iceland. You went to Czechoslovakia to study classical violin. There you met and married artist Woody Veselka. You moved to New York in 1965, where you were immediately immersed in the avant-garde scene there. How did you begin working with video and electronic media?
I was kind of trapped in the music scene. I didn't know that it was so terrible to be a freelancer musician in New York, but it was really getting to me, so it was an escape for me.
So you were doing classical violin gigs.
Yeah.
You were unhappy about it, and so instead you took up this thing that nobody had even heard of.
That's right. It's not logic.
But how did you get into it? How did you even hear about it?
Well,
what were people doing?
You mentioned Woody, my husband. He was a filmmaker, so for him it was natural to start snooping into this new medium. And as soon as I had my hands on it, I never let go.
What was it that pulled you in? I mean, one of the things that's so interesting to me about your work is that it's really not video as a kind of film, but different. You're really exploring the possibilities of video as its own medium.
Yeah, it's kind of a default because I cannot do any kind of narrative. I don't see stories. I don't like beginning, middle, end. And so I have to do something else that kind of brings it closer to the visual art instead of the narrative art.
And so what was it that you saw in video early on? One of the things that you wrote about or talked about, and something that I was reading, was this whole phenomenon of video feedback.
Yeah. Yeah. We just sat for hours and hours in the evening, long into the night, and just watched this thing, because we were trying to see if it ever repeated. We thought maybe there was a pattern that would go, you know, repeat as a loop every maybe few seconds or minutes or whatever, but it doesn't. It's like fire. Looking in the fireplace in the evening.
For our listeners, what is video feedback?
Well, you point just the camera into the monitor, and the whole system gets confused because, you know, it is looking at what it is seeing, the camera, and it can't really do that. So it makes these incredibly beautiful patterns. And I have talked to at least 20 people who discovered it and thought that they were the first one to have ever done this. And the joy of it is just unbelievable when you do this for the first time.
It's funny, with things like that, the joy of doing it is one thing. Then for when you present this, say, as a work of art, is it also joyful for the people watching it?
That I don't know. I mean, I'm not a judge of that. It's joyful for me. I'm hoping I'm sending it to them, that they are getting a message. But it's out of my control.
What was the nature of your collaboration with Woody?
Well, it was so difficult in the beginning. There were so many technical difficulties in cable breaking, and it was such an upstart, you know, that we just needed each other. We were each other assistants. And we did in that period a lot of works where, in retrospect, we have no idea who did what, but in other works I say, well, this is typical Woody work. And so that's the collaboration. But as soon as we were technically good on our own, we split, not in the marriage, but in the art making.
Very interesting. Did your work then diverge and really go in different directions?
Yeah. Yeah.
Jean Youngblood, were you in New York at that time witnessing all of this?
No. Los Angeles.
Uh-huh.
But you have written about this extensively.
Yes.
What was happening in Los Angeles? Was there a similar avant-garde going on there?
Actually, nothing. The the early video movement, which we called alternative video at the time, was basically centered in New York, Chicago, and San Francisco. But I was very interested in it. New media is what we called it, still do.
Now, new media is a term that seems like it could mean almost anything. What does it mean?
Yeah. Well, in this case, today, it means digital. It means the digital way of doing the moving image. I'd like to point out something. If you take the term moving image to include any possible moving image, right, you could say that there's been three milestones in the history of that. When movies were invented was the first one. Then in the late 60s, when video became available to people other than the broadcasters. And then today, where there's an enormous revolution going on in the digital way of doing these things. And I just want to point out that Stena was arguably, you know, one of the top two or three leading figures in that second milestone.
We're talking to Stena and to Gene Youngblood. Stena, you're a musician first of all, and you were working when you got into video with electronic sounds and ambient sounds as well as music. What were the sources of the sound in your videos, and what was the driver? Was it the picture first or the sound, or were they inextricably linked? How did it work?
Yeah, all three, as you say. It was so interesting because I had always thought of music something I generate by putting a bow on a string. And suddenly I discovered that sound making is actually, in the electronic realm, is signal. And this signal is something that can change the sound, amplitude and pitch. And in video, it can change the image. It can even generate an image. You can just have some oscillators or a video or an audio synthesizer and make images. Now, these are, of course, very abstract. It is easier to generate them from a camera, but you can generate them from a camera and then treat them as a signal so that they are unrecognizable as having ever been camera images. So the idea is you can alter audio, pre-recorded or recorded audio track, to alter the image, or you can do it the other way. You can have an image, and through the image alters the audio or generates the audio. Or a third possibility is to have a signal that is generated outside both and affects both at the same time. And this is so fascinating. You sit there for hours just lost, and then you get up and look at the clock and you don't know where you were.
I was wondering, when I was watching some of your work, I was thinking about the experience of a composer in the classical tradition composing a piece of music that has a beginning, middle, and end. And then you have some of these works like the sound and visual of somebody hitting a piece of metal on an anvil with a hammer and the sound that's generated from that. And then you're composing that into a visual and an audio work. How is that similar to or different from other kinds of musical composition?
Well, it doesn't have the structure. It doesn't have the sonata form ABA. It doesn't have... songs, if you think of songs, they always have beginning, middle, end, and maybe endless repetition of the song, but that's like a loop. If you're talking electronic, these repetitions become loops. The materials is so different that I would just call both of them audio. But everything else falls outside. I mean, you're not listening to a Mozart symphony, let's face it.
So, what visual content were you working with, and how did the content relate to the experimentation that you were doing with the medium itself?
Gee, I don't even know how to answer it. But you see, everything was steps. You stepped from discovering video, discovering how to manipulate it, and it was so primitive then that you often just pointed the camera at a monitor, played an image, and re-recorded it with some new information with it. And then we discovered that again, in the realm of signal, that you could take a black and white signal and colorize it. And that is in itself totally revolutionary. I mean, if you want to do anything like that in film, it's a whole lab process and, chemistry and things like that. In video, it is just a special circuit. It's always a box with an input and an output. And so we could alter the colors of our black and white footage. And that is very exciting. And it took years for me to understand colors, to feel comfortable with using colors.
Did it matter what you were coloring? I mean, whether it was a picture of a tree or a human being or a rock and roll scene or whatever?
No, I mean, you just try everything, but eventually this so-called aesthetic creeps in, and you realize that you have actually very clear idea of what you want and what you don't want. This editorial process that every artist goes through, some of them are very aware of it, others just do it. We call it in often template, and you will ask somebody, why didn't you include this scene? And they will look at you and say, I couldn't do that at this indoor. I was doing a tape about outdoor. And it's totally ridiculous. But and only when you're asked, do you have the answer? Where you limited yourself? What was permissible and what was not? And that's the process I have basically followed.
We're talking to Stena, and she has an exhibition opening at a retrospective at Site Santa Fe that opens this Friday from 5 to 7, and also there's a members opening on Thursday from 5 to 7. We'll be talking about that more at the end. Tell us about the space called the kitchen. I think, was it first called the electronic kitchen?
Yeah, but it was really a kitchen. It was an old abandoned kitchen, and we were so tired of having people in our house at all hours watching our tapes. We couldn't take it anymore, so it was great to find another place. And this kitchen had wooden ice boxes. It was maybe even from last century, I don't know.
Wooden ice boxes?
Yeah. Have you seen them?
No.
We threw them out of the window down to the street. There was a catch down on the street for them to get them out. And now I think they would have been such a collector's item, we would have probably gotten thousands of dollars for them. But that's how we had to clean up the space. And it was done all over New York in the late 60s, early 70s. The artists were invading the lofts in Soho. And this was in Soho. This was on Mercer Street and 3rd or 4th or something like that. So people would tell us, you cannot have anything down there, nobody will come. That's like 1971. It was still such a wasteland that people said, it's very unwise, why don't you try to have the theater somewhere where there is a traffic? And we, just within a month from opening, we were in the center of New York. I mean, has been ever since.
And so what kind of work, I mean, this was not only a space for your own work and Woody's work, but so many artists who were working with new media, working with the electronic media, came and showed their work there. What was it like? What kind of things were people showing?
They were showing the current things. I mean, people would come with a tape after we had opened the evening show, which was kind of often improvised, you know. People just came and first served, got to show their tapes. They would be coming breathless, like at 9 o'clock, and say, is there still time to show my tape? I just finished it. I haven't even looked at it yet. So it was really kind of that exciting.
And, I mean, again, were people really just experimenting with the medium in that way that's abstract? Were they doing narrative things? I mean, what was it like?
Yeah, they could do anything they wanted to. I mean, this was about the birth of performance art, which I didn't know much about and didn't like much and thought we should not have it. But when people come knocking on your door and say, I have a performance piece, you're not you're not going to oppose it. So that's how we ran it. And eventually it ran away from us. I mean, we couldn't even get a space to show our own work because it got eventually so desirable to show there.
And as you said, as reading somewhere, you didn't really curate. You just, people wanted to show their work and they got to show their work. They might charge, they might not. There's actually a quotation that I found on a website about the kitchen that was attributed to you and Woody. I'm not sure, I guess if you were in total mind meld at the time, you were writing it together or whatever. But you said, there is time to sit down and just surrender. There is no reason to entertain minds anymore because that has been done and did not help. It just does not help, and there is no help anyway. There is just surrender the way you surrender to the Atlantic Ocean, the way you listen to the wind or the way you watch the sunset, and that is the time you don't regret and that you had nothing else to do. You don't regret that you had nothing else to do. And I was thinking about that, and I was sort of wondering, what's the difference between surrendering yourself to the Atlantic Ocean and surrendering yourself to art?
Yeah, I ask myself the same question. Is there? I mean, you're surrendering your being. But for us, it was this, that there was a lot of drug in this period, and there were various drugs, like there were the good ones, where people sat down and opened their mouth and their mind and looked at the stuff. And there were the speed drugs, where people always had to be at the next thing. And this was basically meant for the speeders. Sit down. Just look at what's in front of you. Because videotapes have always a tendency to be too long and be what's called long and boring, unless you surrender to it like the Atlantic Ocean. Because nobody says the Atlantic Ocean is boring. That was kind of a pun. We enjoyed writing this.
Right. I wanted to talk about the concept of real time. You were doing image manipulation and electronic manipulation in your work in real time. First of all, what does real time mean?
It's a big thing. And it was so big because until then, no moving images were done in real time. They called real time often in film when you pulled the trigger on the camera and didn't stop until the reel ran out. It is a kind of like a real time because there's no starting and stopping or manipulation in between.
So a 10-minute scene takes 10 minutes to show, and time isn't compressed the way it is in a narrative movie.
Yeah, that's Andy Warhol was very much in that. You can actually, you know much more about that. Do you call, Gene, do you call real time what I call real time, or what's your definition?
Yes, no, I agree.
Yeah. Because then but for us, it was an hour. We could, the reel wouldn't run out in a whole hour. So, and we were, we could be watching it, and a whole herds of people could be watching this hour as it was being made, which you never could do in film either. And this whole idea that the viewfinder wasn't necessarily on the camera. See, in film, you always have to have it attached to the cameraman, and you have to see everything through his eye. And suddenly there is this idea that camera is a certain box, and then you can be looking at a monitor far away and seeing it in real time, as we say. So you saw the image while it was being made. And this is very much in my thoughts with the piece in the lobby at the site. It's called All Vision. That was kind of a rebellion against this idea that somebody would be making the image, because I attached two cameras on a turntable, and it observes the room without any input from me.
So at site, I saw that piece the other day. There's a camera, and it's on an arm that's kind of revolving around the room, and you get to see on a monitor yourself, everybody else in the room. And does that then, does it go to tape, or is it just what you see is what you get in that moment?
As you want. It is not going on tape at the moment, but it could at any point. There is another piece in the show called The West, where I went all over the Southwest with this huge turntable and plunked it down, like in Chaco Canyon, or the very large array. So you can do either, but it's a performance. It's just a totally different concept. And doing it for the first time was just so exciting. Now everybody does it all the time. And think about all the surveillance cameras that are on every roof and in every street. They don't have viewfinders because there's no person there.
And that's a real-time video.
Yeah, that's a real-time video, if you ever saw one.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
When you started doing video, did you still continue playing the violin very seriously? Did you stop?
I stopped totally. I was so glad to be out of there. And I didn't even listen to classical music for a long time. But I didn't have to, because this is the time when we would be asking, when is the next Who album coming? When is the next Beatle album? And where are the Stones? And, you know, we used to call them albums and LP. They were all on LP. And nobody knows even what that means anymore.
As a friend of mine said, vinyl, man.
Vinyl. But anyhow, so there was a very exciting time to listen to popular music. So I didn't miss classical whatsoever.
Well, you did a piece called Violin Power, which is an ongoing piece that I guess has had many incarnations over the years. Tell us about that piece, because you're playing the violin like a classical violin player, but then it turns into other things.
Yeah, that's again, as I was talking about this signal, that in this case, the stroking the string with a bow generates a signal that turns into an electronic signal and manipulates both the sound, which I'm making, and the image by the camera that is looking at me. So I become both the crew and the performer and anybody else. Because I was always totally alone when I did them. So that is the analog part of doing violin power. But then in the mid-90s or so, it started to be possible to do these kind of performances live with the help, of course, of computer and software. And that is when it became a performance that I could easily do anytime, anywhere. And there's a big discussion that we are not going to have this morning about analog and digital. But everybody who does video thinks about this. And all the young guys who are now DJs, so-called VJs, video jockeys, they are desiring these old analog instruments. They are very exciting to them, just like LP is vinyl for the disc jockeys in audio.
So, you went at a certain point to Buffalo, New York. You left this whole New York avant-garde scene. Why did you go, and what did you do in Buffalo?
I didn't really go to Buffalo. I mean, we were lured up there to give a course for 12 weeks. And we realized that the place was incredibly cheap. The rent was almost free, and very good condition and excellent colleagues, because Buffalo, for some strange reason, is a cultural oasis up there. It's a dying city, has been dying for the last 40, 50 years. So it was kind of ideal for us, and we found a good place to work and live in. And we stayed on for 6 years. So 12 weeks, got into 6 years. And then there was too much snow, the two snow winters, one after the other. And we just said to each other, Santa Fe. We didn't even really know what it meant, but it was just kind of a catchword, Santa Fe. So.
And so you just decided to move out here, barely knowing what you were getting into?
Well, we made that little spy trip, like in the fall of 79. We kind of spied it out. And we came, so it's so strange, we came way too late at night into town from the airport. And we found La Fonda Hotel, the end of the trail. And we just signed in for it the first night. And it is so cute. We got a little room. It was rather a closet up, down long corridors. And then we wake up in the morning, and there's a realtor on first floor there. And we say, how about real estate? And he starts sending us to people. He just took one look at us and says, there is a center for contemporary art. It wasn't called that then. It was called Rising Sun. And there are people there that you ought to meet. and that was Bob Gaylor and Linda Klosky. And they sent us there, and everything we did and everybody we met was, yes, 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 this is the place, this is where you come. So then we filled up a big truck, like everybody else does, and drove down here.
And so how did your work change when you got here, if it did?
Oh, I just didn't want to change anything. This was so seductive, this blue sky everywhere, you know, and I just got a color camera, and I was not going to let it affect me, and there was just no way. I mean, first of all, I didn't really have a studio. That's the problem in Santa Fe. You can't have those big New York lofts. So I had to make outdoors my studio. And I remember I walked out one morning, and when I had given up, and I said, my studio has endless space. There are no real walls, and the ceiling is blue. And that's how I'm going to work now.
It's so funny that you would come to a place and say, I'm not going to let it affect me.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, everybody else comes and they're desperate to let the place affect them.
I was not going to be a landscape artist. It's such an old-fashioned idea. I mean, wasn't I kind of a modernist and maybe even postmodernist, whatever it means? I don't know what it means. But, you know, you don't go and do landscapes. That's 2 centuries ago or so. So that was my resistance.
Uh-huh.
In vain.
In vain, because some, for example, that piece that you were talking about that has a sort of pyramid, multiple monitors, is has very much of the colors and the flavor of the Southwest.
Yeah, really. I mean, it is deeply inspired by the land and the spirituality of the land, because the scenes are, as I say, from Chaco Canyon, which is one of the most remarkable lands anywhere close by here. And then the very large array, which for me is also very spiritual, because it was actually, this whole thing was built to listen for intelligence in outer space. They never found any, but so they will listen
for us. Or they haven't told us.
They haven't told us. We have to go to Roswell.
We're talking to Stena, and her exhibition is opening this Friday at Site Santa Fe. It's Stena 1970 to 2000. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about was the use of multiple monitors, or now multiple screens. Why so many? Sometimes it's the same image on many monitors. Sometimes it's different images. Why use multiple monitors?
Well, it maybe was in vogue at the time, because there were no way to project video. But I think that it was mostly because we came up on a bargain. We could buy 3 monitors for $300 instead of 1 for $100. So right from the get-go, we always looked at everything on 3 monitors when we were composing and editing and selecting. So that it became like an addiction, and we did a lot of things that would be moving on the horizontal axis, so give you a feeling that it was going from one monitor to another, these kind of illusions. And since it was arguably the first video instrument we ever bought, it was definitely before we bought a camera, we became the multi-monitor artists.
I think I was reading somewhere where you said that if horizontal drift on one monitor looks like a mistake, on 3 monitors it looks like art.
Exactly. That's how we decided it was art.
So you use a lot of natural elements in your work, maybe more your later work, I don't know, maybe more when you got to New Mexico, but incredible images of fire and smoke and water and trees. What, I mean, was this like surrendering to the Atlantic Ocean? I mean, what? Why so much of that? Where does that imagery come from, and what does it do?
See, I wouldn't say that that the fire on metal has much to do with nature. I did it with Tom Joyce, who is the blacksmith emeritus in town. But we started just doing images, and then Tom knew exactly what was, because he's a pyromaniac, well, I'm too, and he knew exactly what images he could generate by blowing with a blowtorch on them. So we blew in water, we blowtorched papers, and then there was this hammering on a steel and everything. So that's not really a nature thing. Of course, the West is. But then I have something in there called Tokyo 4, which is a totally urban piece. So taking it all together, I've always known this since I started in media, that I'm not so interested in the image itself. The image is something that just hits my lens, and I accept it. So because people say, did you make a great effort to get this picture? I usually don't. I just, and sometimes, like in my studio, if there is a chair there that ought not to be there, I don't remove it, because that's not what I'm doing, is to arrange spaces in front of the camera. It's just to take it with what it is. Does that answer your question?
Sure. I mean, it's a different aesthetic or a different way of looking and thinking that probably most people are used to who watch narrative film or expect a story or even expect a composed painting or something like that.
Yeah.
What does your work look like to you now when you look back at things that you did 30, 40 years ago?
Yeah, I'm kind of happy to report that it doesn't look so bad, because I've always, you go through these periods first of being totally in love with it and thinking everybody else is, and then you show it to maybe a group of people and you say, oh, no, that didn't really work. It's, they don't see it, they don't get it. And then you go through the next period, which is, it's not kind of so bad, and it's not your work anymore. You have disassociated yourself from the work, and you see it as if anybody else had done it. But then when you look at it like 30 years later, you know exactly. And looking at that, my harvest is pretty good. There are a lot of works that I actually like from 30 years ago. And it could be the other way. I could hate them all.
Well, I guess I want to ask you, and maybe this is a question that can't be answered, but how do you see differently, and how do, you know, your regular average viewers see differently than they did in 1970? Because the world of seeing is so different now because of the image saturation and the media thing.
Mm. It is very different, and I actually don't really even know how people see it. I never know how they see it. But a lot of people today ought to take our admonition about the Atlantic Ocean. You know, there are just a lot of lack of attention span going on, where people stick their nose into a room full of monitors and stay there for maybe 20 seconds or less and run to the next thing. But, you know, you feel horribly rejected, but what can you do? You spend maybe months putting something together and somebody just looks at it for a second, it's gone.
Well, it's interesting. I sat there on the very comfortable couch at Site Santa Fe yesterday and watched the whole Tokyo loop, which doesn't really have a beginning, I guess. You can come in at any time and watch the whole thing. But the thing that was striking to that about me is that one projects so much of one's own imagination onto what's going on there, because so much of it is first of all, it's a foreign culture, but one can't really understand what's going on there, so you have to make sense of it just through your imagination.
Yeah, I like that, because that's what I did. I was in Tokyo, and I didn't understand any of this culture. It was like a performance space, or a street theater. People were bowing, they were using sign language, they had white gloves like the taxi drivers, and I felt I was just witness to this. I was very thrilled to witness it and not understand what it was, and that's what I wanted to convey to other people. They can just look at it and say, why do they have white gloves, you know? And nobody can tell you why.
Well, it's funny to raise questions like that, though, without answering them, because everybody wants answers.
Yeah. There is a scene in there that Japanese think is very natural. I have a cemetery, of aborted fetuses and stillborn babies. And it's a cemetery on a long row with little Buddha statues. And first you just can't believe it, but then you understand people grieve. They grieve aborted fetuses, even if they aborted them. It is maybe much more human to raise a little memorial and come and water the plants and everything. But when I understood what it was that I was seeing, I couldn't believe it. I'd never heard, and I don't know if any other culture on earth does this, you know. So, but the people just look at this cemetery, they don't know what they're seeing any more than I did.
We're talking to Stena. I think it's important to talk also about the concept of installation. What is an installation as opposed to a video screening?
It's something that's inherent in the medium. As I said, you know, you can have a single camera and 100 monitors. You can arrange them in space. You can. It is unnatural for this medium to make an installation and to then mix it with other media and have video as just one component of other things. So I didn't even know the word installation, and I'm not sure it was there at the time we started doing it. So I always called it environments, which I still today think is a much better term, because installation is like when the plumber comes and puts some pipes into your house or something. But that term has stuck. Was installation used in before 1970? Did anybody make installation? I don't know, like painters or...
You mean, did they use that word?
First of all, did they use that word?
No.
Were they doing installations, even though they didn't use that word?
Yes, but they were very minimal. You typically never saw anything like what Stena did. It would usually be one projection, maybe, but not even projection, because projectors then were horrible. So I don't know if this is answering the question. They did not use the term installation, and most of what we think of as installation today was not happening. It was just beginning.
Yeah, I know Bruce Nauman. He started giving his tapes, which were on open reel, to gallery, and they would thread it up and play it, and it would go out at the other end, and nobody would know how to rewind it. But, yeah, that was an installation.
Let me ask you something. How much of this work survives? I know that some of the, a lot of the early video work, let me ask you this, Gene Youngblood. I mean, that was a very fragile, early video is a very fragile medium. Is any of it still around? Has it been archived or saved?
Yes. There are many different archives in this country. Two of the biggest ones are actually distributors. There's an organization called Electronic Arts Intermix in New York. And in Chicago, there's the Chicago Video Data Bank. These people distribute to the... academic world. They rent tapes, rent and sell tapes to colleges and universities. They have enormous archives of early stuff. Then there are individuals like myself and the Vasilkas. We have large archives as well. And in fact, today there's a huge movement to digitally copy all this stuff so we don't lose it.
Were you thinking at a certain point about saving your work? I mean, that footage from the late 60s must be incredibly, I don't mean financially valuable, but just valuable as a document of that time.
Well, emotionally valuable to me,
yeah.
Very much, yeah, because this is how I learned how to tape, you know, how to go on location, to do camera work. But I was so lucky that the gay scene in New York... heard about me and heard that I would tape them. And since they were theater people and a lot of transvestites, and they were basically the Warhol crowd, they were thrilled to be on camera. And they were thrilled to be able to see back what they had done. So I didn't even have to approach anybody. Just the phone would ring and, come over now, we are going to do this and things like that. So that I always have considered that different activity. It is this documentation of kind of weird happenings and stuff is not related to what I do as so-called art.
I'm struck in reading about that time and thinking about it, how free the world seemed then as opposed to now.
Oh, yeah. It's unbelievable. Like, when we run the kitchen, you know, somebody would come and say, can I show something there? And first, in the beginning, we could say, do you want Thursday or Friday? And then when it got a little more, we would say, we have finished our calendar for this month, but you can come in any time next month. And we would never ask them what they wanted to do. And that was not considered original. That was considered normal.
Yeah.
That you could do these things, you know.
At that point, equipment was very expensive. Now, virtually anybody can buy a digital camera, a video camera, a still camera. Everybody's got their Macintosh. How has the advancement of media changed what you do and what you see other artists doing?
Hugely. You know, the people started, it was so expensive that all these cooperatives sprung up all over, not only New York, but the rest of the country, where people would buy the rig and share it between like 5 or 6 or 7 people, which was always restrictive too. And talking about that, it's interesting that the natives, just like around here in the Pueblos and also a lot in Oklahoma, they bought this equipment right there when nobody else was using it, and they have huge archives of stuff. And the native people here from the Pueblos are very astute in media. They do crews all over, like for the museums and everywhere. I have no explanation for this, but that was just a strike of luck that they picked it up so early. But that was, again, the same thing. It was the whole tribe owned the equipment, and that's why they could buy it.
What was your role in designing the show that's at Site Santa Fe now and selecting the work that's in it?
This is a curated show. I have nothing to do with the selection because the word curare means to choose. So curator comes and chooses work. So it was their choice. Mostly Liza Stanton and Laura Hion, who's the director.
So you didn't take part in putting together the installation? They just did it?
They mostly did it. It's a very knowledgeable and good crowd there, especially the technical people. But I stuck my nose in there all the time, you know, and I was on a short leash too if they needed to know something. It is totally different than if you have to make a show somewhere else on the planet where you're not there, you know, because they didn't use me much, and they didn't have to. But that's how it is done professionally. And since this is my first professional show, I'm kind of learning that part of it.
What do you mean, your first professional show?
Well, I have participated in a lot of shows, but this is kind of a one-man show on a scale where I have nothing to do with the curatorship and very little to do with how it is arranged in space and how it is allocated. So I just stepped aside and watched how that world works. I'm not very involved in the art world. See, this is the art world. And I am in the media world.
Right.
And I have very little knowledge and actually totally no interest in the art world as the world. I'm interested always in artists and artists' work in any medium. So this is all news to me.
Stena, what are you working on now?
I'm doing snippets at the time. I see something, and see, this is what's so different. You always had to tape it. But now I just make a file. Something interesting comes up, and you're working on the computer, and you say, this is usable. And you export it onto your desktop of your computer, and you call it by some name that you can find it again. And it is so different from having to use tape. Some part of it is, of course, a lot better, this instant access. But in certain ways, I'm very sentimental about the old days, because somebody would say, like, can I have that? I would say, sure, I'll make you a copy. And it would be so easy. You just put one cassette to feed and another to copy, and it would be done. But suddenly you face 110 codexes and different ways of compression. And if it doesn't, I'm not very good at this, so I make a mistake and have to do it again. And it is just not my medium in that sense, but it is certainly a pleasure to hand somebody over a DVD that you have made. You know, it's an elegant medium, but it's kind of mysterious how why the copying didn't work, or when it works, and sometimes it looks better than copied than the original.
And it's funny because, I mean, media like oil painting or watercolor or bronze sculpting never go away, but media like half-inch video are gone forever.
Forever, except what was copied over to some other medium.
And nobody, yeah, exactly, but nobody's actually using it. So the yeah. phenomenon of working with that medium is only a memory of people like you.
Well, I think about especially America, U.S., but also the rest of the world, this closet full of old equipment, you know, and people throw out too much because now there are collectors that pay money for those things. But there must be unbelievable stacks of usable equipment that's just obsolete.
Well, Stain, I want to thank you so much for spending all this time with us here in the Santa Fe Baking Company. And Jean Youngblood, who's been very quiet, we want to thank you, too. And Juliet Myers has just joined us to let us know what is going on. The opening of the exhibition Stain in 1970 to 2000 opens at Site Santa Fe this Friday from 5 to 7. And the members opening is on Thursday from 5 to 7. If you are not a member and you want to join, you can call 989-1199. And Juliet, there's also a lecture.
Absolutely. This is the kickoff of the Art Feast weekend that the Santa Fe Gallery Association puts on. And each year for this very special weekend raising money for arts for children in the schools and otherwise, the weekend kicks off at Site Santa Fe on Thursday, February 21st at 6 p.m. At that time, there will be a wonderful party at Site Santa Fe in celebration of Art Feast and Stana's exhibition. There will be food and wine. And you can get a ticket for this contemporary encounter with Laura Heon, and she will be lecturing about Stana's work that evening. So food, wine, and the wonderful, entertaining words and ideas of Laura Heon about Stana's work, that starts at 6 p.m. Tickets are available through the Lenzic at 988-1234. So all of your Art Feast gala events are available through the Lenzic ticket office.
Juliet, thank you so much. Thanks. Jean Youngblood, and thank you, Stana.
A pleasure.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Ciao.